Want a chance to win 250 pounds in vouchers? All you have to do is fill out the Ballpark's listener survey. It takes just 15 minutes. The Ballpark podcast is celebrating our 10th anniversary in 2026. And after more than 130 episodes covering U.S. politics, we want to hear from you to shape our next decade. So hit the link in the show notes for the survey details and prize draw terms and conditions. Share your thoughts, and you could be 250 pounds better off.
Hello, and welcome to The Ballpark, a podcast from the Phelan U.S. Center here at the London School of Economics. I'm Chris Gilson, managing editor of the Phelan U.S. Center's blog on U.S. politics and policy, USAP. The last two decades have seen significant growth in the relationship between China and the EU. Now, China is the EU's biggest import and third largest export partner. But this relationship is becoming increasingly one-sided, with China's industrial policy and economic protections making it more and more difficult for Europe to sell its products there. And at the same time, there are fears that new high-value manufacturing competition from China could lead to deindustrialization in Europe, with Germany potentially most at risk. These challenges are further complicated by the unpredictability of the US under the Trump administration and internal divides on China between EU member states. To discuss these issues, in March 2026, I spoke to Noah Barkin, senior advisor at the Rhodium Group. His work focuses on Europe-China relations and transatlantic China policy. I really enjoyed our conversation, and I hope you do too. So thanks so much for joining us on The Ballpark today. Just to start things off, could you briefly introduce yourself and the sort of things you're working on at the moment?
Sure. Well, good to be here. So I am based in Berlin for Rhodium Group, which is a US-based research and advisory firm that's focused on China and energy and climate issues. I work in a team that advises companies and governments on China-related issues. Before that, I was a journalist for 25 years, mainly with Reuters, began in the US, but I've been in Europe for almost 30 years. And also worth mentioning, I do a monthly column called Watching China in Europe, which is sort of a behind-the-scenes look at what people in Brussels and Berlin and Paris and other capitals are saying and thinking about China. So that is available on Substack.
Thank you so much. So my first question is really, how has the EU responded to the rise of China as a major economic power since the 1990s?
Well, I think in the first decade and a half of this century, it was a story of closer, ever closer economic and also political ties. So China was, I think, a vital economic crutch for Europe during the global financial crisis. Of course, China unleashed a massive stimulus. The Chinese economy continued growing while Europe and the US were really struggling. So it evolved into a very lucrative market for European companies over this period. So I would say in the 2008 to 2015 period, I think we've seen a shift over the past decade where China has evolved into a formidable economic and industrial competitor. So I'm based in Germany. What we're seeing in Germany is sort of deindustrialization at the moment. And part of the reason for that is competition from China. So you have an increasing number of German companies, German sectors, that are calling for protection, whether it's through local content rules in Europe or trade defense tools. So we've gone from what was, I think, a win-win relationship to one that is increasingly a zero-sum industrial competition. And that, of course, has changed the view of China in Germany and also in other European countries.
And what challenges does the EU currently face as China looks set to overtake the US in economic might in many ways?
Well, I think this is the dilemma that Europe faces. I think China is a vast market. It's the second biggest economy in the world. So Europe wants to maintain a close economic relationship with China for no other reason than to sell its products. But that's becoming increasingly difficult. As I mentioned, competition from China has become more intense. We've seen a sharp drop in German exports to China just over the past 3 years, roughly 25%. decline in exports. So I think we're moving from a period where Europe could export to China and make profits in China and compete with China in third markets to one where all three are going to become more difficult. So that doesn't mean that there aren't European companies out there that are still doing well in China, but China is just becoming much more of an economic challenge. I think fair to say, seen more as an economic threat now than as an economic opportunity, which that was the dominant narrative in the first decade and a half of this century.
And if I may, I'd just like to delve into a bit more about the competition between the EU and China. You're talking about fewer EU exports going to China. Sounds like more imports coming from China. What's the crux of the competition? Is it on price? Is it on quality? Is it that China just doesn't need as much from the EU because they're building their own products?
Yeah, it's a combination of things, really. I think all of the factors that you mentioned. So China is able to produce more cheaply. I think in the past, it was mainly about labor costs, but increasingly it's about just the industrial ecosystem that China has built, where time to market is much faster, where the entire supply chain is present from critical raw materials to processing to manufacturing inputs, intermediate goods. So as an example, Volkswagen, the German car maker, has said they can produce an electric vehicle 50% more cheaply in China. And there are other factors, subsidies, a vast market that is still quite protected. And so foreign companies have certainly done well in China, but when Chinese competitors emerge, they find themselves being slowly pushed out of the market. So there are many factors involved. China launched this Made in China 2025 initiative back in 2015, where it sought dominance in 10 key industries. It hasn't all gone according to plan, but in certain areas, China has taken a long view and, for example, leapfrogged European car makers by moving into electric vehicles and develop technology, for example, electric batteries, that is further ahead than European competitors. So it's really a combination of a very top-down industrial policy underpinned by subsidies, the industrial ecosystem that China has created, and a number of other factors, including technological advances.
So as a major trading partner with both the US and China, how does the EU attempt to balance between these two powers? And how successful has the bloc been in trying to achieve this?
Well, I think it's becoming harder as the economic relationship with the US and China becomes more challenging. If you go back to the Biden administration, you had a robust transatlantic discussion on how to respond to China. The EU, for example, developed its economic security agenda, so sort of de-risking agenda based on a very close conversation with Washington. So this was about restricting trade and investment selectively due to national security concerns. This discussion has ground to a halt for all intents and purposes under the Trump administration. There is now a debate about de-risking from the U.S. in Europe. And the dependencies, of course, on China and on the U.S. are different. With China, it's very much about industrial goods, critical minerals. With the U.S., it's about defense. It's about certain technologies like cloud infrastructure. So Europe is trying to strike a balance. I think we've had a lot of talk about de-risking. I'm not sure how much actual de-risking has taken place. And right now, I think Europe is feeling very vulnerable because it is very concerned about this industrial competition from China. At the same time, it's very worried about the Trump administration's tariffs, the future of its reliance on the U.S. as a security guarantor. So very difficult decisions have to be made in Europe about how to balance these two superpowers.
So you mentioned the tariffs as well. What impact has Trump's return to the White House, and specifically his tariff policies, had on the EU's triangular relationship with the US and China economically?
Well, I think there are a few things to mention there. One, Trump started with Liberation Day roughly a year ago, beginning of April 2025, when Trump imposed broad-based tariffs on many US trading partners. And following that, there was an escalation with China. I think U.S. tariffs on China reached 145% at one point. And then there were talks between the U.S. and China, and the two sides were able to de-escalate and U.S. tariffs came down. But that did force China or encourage China to hit back. And so Europe was affected by the retaliation from China to the US tariffs. And I'm thinking in particular of export controls on critical raw materials, rare earth magnets, which affected the US, but also affected Europe and other partners. So I think Europe in a way was collateral damage in this trade conflict between the US and China. Now the US and China have put this conflict sort of on ice. There was a meeting between Trump and Xi in South Korea last year at the end of October. So that has been suspended. These export controls have been suspended for a year, but that is a real threat for Europe. I think the other factor is that the US has just sucked up a lot of bandwidth in Europe. So I think before Trump came in, there was a very intense focus on China. There were new measures and economic security agenda being rolled out. And there was this very close conversation going on China policy between the US and Brussels. That is no longer there. And whether it's threats against Greenland, whether it's Venezuela, Iran, whether it's the US tariffs, that has sucked up a lot of policy bandwidth. So less time to focus on the very complex challenges that China poses. And I think it has made the tensions in the transatlantic relationship have made Europe, certainly European capitals, more cautious vis-a-vis China. Nobody wants to be in a two-front conflict with the two major superpowers. So we are seeing, and we've seen this flurry of recent visits by European leaders to Beijing, an attempt to manage this relationship, to avoid conflict on two fronts. The big word these days is realism. And usually people talk about realism when things are not going too well. So that has also been a factor, these transatlantic tensions, making Europe a bit more cautious when it comes to China.
So is it possible for the EU to have a relationship with China, which is not linked in some way to its relationship with the United States?
Well, I think there is a misperception that a lot of the measures that Europe has taken aimed at China in recent years were driven by the US. I think certainly under the first Trump administration, under the Biden administration, there was pressure coming from Washington for Europe to take certain steps. But a lot of these measures have been driven by the internal debate in Europe and the growing concerns about China, whether it's on the economic front, on the security front. So I think my first point would be to say that Europe does have its own China policy, that it's not, as Chinese officials often suggest, that it's not driven by Washington, even if Washington has had some influence over the years. But I would say that, of course, if you're sitting in Brussels or Berlin or Paris, how the US is behaving has an influence on how, I mean, the US has been a huge ally for Europe for many decades. And I don't think you can completely divorce the transatlantic relationship from the EU-China relationship. I think it's a bit of a triangle, and that triangle moves in different directions. But Europe certainly pays attention to what the Trump administration is doing when it's thinking about how it's going to behave with China.
So in a recent article, you talked about the risk of a China shock for Germany's economy and industry. Could you talk a bit about what a China shock means in this context and how it might impact the domestic industries of EU member states?
Sure. Well, I think the term China shock comes from what I think the US experienced after China's entry into the WTO in 2001, which was really sort of an outsourcing of jobs, which devastated parts of US industry. I think this China shock, and there's a debate about whether shock is the right term, because shock sort of implies surprise, but I think a lot of people saw this coming. So in a way, it's not a surprise. I think it is a shock in terms of the impact that it's having on the European economy and European industry. But I've also heard it described as sleepwalking 2.0. So Europe sort of sleepwalking as it did with Russia and the reliance on Russian energy, doing the same with China. So there's a dispute about whether shock is the right word. But this China shock, if we want to call it that, I think is very different than what the US experienced 25 years ago. As I said earlier, China's moved up the value chain. It's a fierce competitor, not so much because of labor costs as with the first China shock, but because of industrial policies underpinned by massive subsidies, a vast protected market, control of the entire supply chain, this industrial ecosystem, which I talked about. So it means you can produce, whether it's a car, a wind turbine, an industrial widget, much more cheaply in China. And that is having an impact on European industry, of course, because it doesn't only mean more competition in China, it increasingly means more competition in third markets, in Europe itself, from Chinese competitors. So Germany is losing roughly 10,000 manufacturing jobs every month over the past couple of years. And Chinese competition is not the only reason for that. Energy prices have gone up since the cutoff of Russian gas. There is a debate in Europe at the moment about the need to cut bureaucracy and deregulate and run faster, so to speak. But I think China is having a major impact on this. And I think Germany as industrial power is the one that is feeling this China shock most. And of course, there are many other countries in Europe, especially in Eastern Europe, that are connected to Germany and German auto supply chains, for example. So they are also feeling the brunt of this. But it means deindustrialization. It means a loss of industrial jobs. And overall, it means less prosperity in Europe.
Thank you. If I could just follow up on that point, is there a risk of a kind of Rust Belt style hollowing out of German industry or industry more widely and in the other places in the EU mentioned? And then with that, that's had huge implications politically in the US. How does this play out over the next 5 or 10 years in terms of industry in the EU, but also its politics, if you're able to talk on that?
Well, we've been looking into this and thinking about what it means looking 3 to 5 years out. And I think it's important to note that industrial dominance, which I think we're heading in that direction, if you look at China right now, that has an impact across the board. It affects your national security. It affects your economy in many ways. It affects your autonomy, your political autonomy, your sovereignty. We're seeing that already with the export controls that China implemented on critical raw materials. This is real leverage that China has against Europe and also against the US and other countries. So in a worst case scenario, if there is not a forceful response, and I would say that response has to come not just from Europe, but has to come from G7 plus group of countries, then we're going to have continued deindustrialization, continued economic problems. And of course, that can have an impact on society more broadly, on political debate. It has obviously been a factor in triggering populist movements in the US, and we're seeing that in Europe as well. So you can paint a pretty bleak scenario of what this looks like longer term if Europe, Japan, the US, the UK, and others do not come together and respond in a forceful way. And that doesn't mean containing China. It doesn't mean necessarily conflict with China. But what it does mean is saying, we're not going to put up with an uneven playing field. We're not going to put up with unfair competition. And we're going to push back and protect our industries. And I mean, China does need the European market. The US market is closing down to Chinese goods to a certain extent. So Europe does have leverage with China. It can say we're going to put up some barriers, whether it's on the investment side, on the trade side, unless we find a way to deal with these widening trade imbalances, these overcapacities that are flooding into Europe. So there is a way that countries can come together and push back against this. My concern is that we're heading in the other direction, especially since Trump has come into office.
Scholars and commentators have noted the lack of EU unity when it comes to facing Russia and the US. Is this also the case with China? And what divisions might exist within the bloc about how it responds to China's economic rise?
Well, we do have divisions within the EU. We're never going to have perfect harmony or perfect alignment within the EU when it comes to the US, when it comes to Russia, when it comes to China. I think the European Commission has been pushing very hard for robust measures. I would say France has emerged as a vocal hardliner in pushing for more aggressive trade defense policies. I think on the other extreme, we've seen a country like Spain adopt a much more opportunistic approach to China, seeking Chinese investment. I think Pedro Sanchez, the Spanish prime minister, is going to head to China in mid-April for the fourth time in 4 years. And then I would say Germany is a bit of a swing state. the biggest European economy, the country with the deepest economic relationship in many ways with China. And I think the debate about China policy in Berlin is probably more intense than in any other capital, but you have different views there. You have some people pushing very hard for Germany to reduce its dependencies on China. They see what has happened with critical raw materials. The Chinese restrictions are a threat to the German auto industry. They're a threat to Germany's push to rebuild its military. But you also have people who believe, and I would say this is a problematic way of viewing it, that if you just run faster, then that solves the issue. So I often say, if you're a manager of a football team and you have 9 players and you tell them to go out and play against a team with 11 players and just run harder, they can run as hard as they want. They're still not going to hold up.
So looking to a different dimension now, how does China's political rise as a regional hegemon and a potential global leader factor into how the EU views the country?
Well, I think especially in the context of a world where the US has become a less predictable, less reliable partner to Europe, and you see China emerging as an industrial powerhouse, you see China's influence growing in the so-called global South, that gives certain European countries pause and they think, okay, what is this going to look like in 5 to 10 years? Do we want to be in conflict with China, or do we want a tense relationship with China when China's power seems to be growing? I would say that is certainly understandable, but at the same time, China has a lot of weaknesses that I think are overlooked, some deep structural problems with its economy, a lack of consumption, a weakness at home, which sort of translates into strength abroad in the sense that a very intense competition at home where companies are struggling to make profits and that forces them to look for profits elsewhere. This is the overcapacity problem that we've discussed. So China has demographic challenges. It has an imbalanced domestic economy, which relies too heavily on exports. And so China may not be seen as the powerhouse that it now is in 5 to 10 years, unless it deals with some of these structural issues in its economy. But given the industrial might that it now has, I think certainly there are some European countries that are saying to themselves, okay, we have to hedge our bets. We have to remain engaged. We have to avoid conflict with China.
So Brussels and Beijing are often portrayed simultaneously as competitors and collaborators economically. How accurate is this portrayal of the EU-China trade relationship?
Well, it is a huge trading relationship, but I think the problem is that it's becoming increasingly imbalanced. And so European exports to China are declining, and I would say have entered a sort of period of structural decline. This is not a fleeting phenomenon. There is less need for European goods. We talked about the fact that China has moved up the value chain, that it is able to produce more and more of what it needs domestically. And that has been a deliberate policy of self-reliance, depending less on others and increasing others' dependencies on China. That is something that under Xi Jinping, China has pursued very explicitly. So I think certainly this relationship is one of the most intense trading relationships, but it's increasingly imbalanced, and that is a problem for Europe. If you can't sell your goods, if China's not importing them, but it's flooding your market with goods, at a certain point that becomes an issue. And I think compounding this issue is what we've seen over the past year, a number of new factors, trade diversion. So U.S. tariffs going up, Chinese exporters diverting exports from the U.S. into Europe, increasing Chinese exports to Europe. We've also seen a decline in the value of the renminbi, China's currency. I think it fell about 8% last year, and it's down about 25% over the past 3 years. So that is making Chinese companies even more competitive outside of China. So I would call this relationship, this is an important trading relationship, but it's also one which is increasingly working to Europe's disadvantage.
We've talked a little bit about the sort of sectors that the EU is kind of worried about China's development and exporting to. But are there any sectors of the EU industry where China really wants to become less dependent on?
Well, Europe still produces some goods that China cannot produce. ASML, the Dutch maker of semiconductor manufacturing equipment, massive machines that can produce the most advanced semiconductors. There is no Chinese ASML. So China does want access to ASML machines. Aerospace is another area. Airline engines made by the French, the Americans. China has started developing its own airliner, but they are still heavily dependent on jet engines from Europe and the US. So there are areas where China still needs goods from Europe. There are also some industrial widgets that they don't produce, but authorities in Beijing have a list of what areas where they are dependent, and they are systematically working through that list and reducing those dependencies. So the goal is not to be reliant on Europe or the US for anything. I think that it's safe to say.
So to what extent is the EU endorsing or even executing a turn towards China in its economic policy? And has this been accelerated or even begun because of President Trump's protectionist policies?
Well, I don't know what that turn towards China really looks like. I think given this industrial competition that I've talked about, I think there are countries that are seeking investment from China and hope that instead of exporting goods into Europe, Chinese companies will set up factories in Europe. They will share know-how, share technology, sort of a reversal of what happened in China with European companies moving in and sharing technology and know-how. I am skeptical whether that can happen. I think so far we haven't had a real surge of Chinese investment in Europe. We have had some, but in terms of car makers, it's been very, very slim pickings. We have a BYD factory in Hungary. We have some investments in Spain, but we haven't seen a flood. And I think the main reason for that is it's still very profitable for Chinese companies to export to Europe. And Europe hasn't really put up the trade barriers that would convince companies that it's a better idea to produce in Europe rather than produce in China and export to Europe. So that is the dilemma right now.
A question for you. Have you filled out the Ballpark survey yet? It's just 15 minutes, helps us get ready for our 10th anniversary. And if you're lucky, you might win 250 pounds in vouchers.
So in a February panel discussion this year, titled Germany Between US and China, Who is the Better Partner? You argued that Berlin risks becoming a pawn in the superpower struggle. Could you talk about the significance of Germany's response for the EU's wider policy stance vis-a-vis China and what challenges it currently faces?
I mean, we've talked about European disunity on China. I think if Germany sorts itself out, I think that can do a lot for European unity. Germany is, as I said earlier, split between two forces. On the one hand, heavy investments by German companies in China. The car makers, for example, have invested very heavily just in the past few years coming out of COVID. And they're making a bet that they can produce cars together with Chinese joint venture partners using this industrial ecosystem that China has to produce cars at a cheaper rate and export those cars, sell them in China, of course, but also export them abroad. So we will see if this strategy is successful over the next year or two as these models roll off the production lines. But Germany also faces, outside of China, a very intense industrial competition in third markets, increasingly at home. So the inclination to protect industry is tempered by the voices of those companies that are in China that have bet the house on China, that see their future being dependent on China, on innovation in China, on producing there for the world, I would say. There is this saying, in China for China, but a lot of companies that say that are what they're really doing is in China for the rest of the world, unless the trade barriers go up. So there is this tension in Germany, but I think Germany is absolutely the country that sets the direction on China in Europe. So it is very important for Germany to send clear signals on where it's headed. Until now, we've gotten a lot of mixed signals.
So we've talked a lot about the EU, Europe's relationship with China, but we are sitting here in London in the UK, so it would be remiss not to at least mention the UK in some way, which still presumably has an important influence. How has the UK's changing relationship with the EU post-Brexit influenced the EU's relationship with China?
It's a good question. I mean, the UK went through a bit of an ice age with China, and we're just coming out of that. Prime Minister Keir Starmer was in China recently, and I think trying to reset or recalibrate, as people in the government say, this relationship in a way very similar to what Canada is doing, which also experienced a period over multiple years where there was very little high-level engagement with China. I see the UK as a bit of a laboratory for openness to China. China, in the sense that there isn't a debate about putting up trade barriers to Chinese car makers. I think something like 20% of new cars sold in the UK are Chinese cars. That's not the case in the EU. So there isn't this debate about putting up these trade barriers. There isn't a debate about other security related issues like connected vehicles, the security risks attached to connected vehicles. There is a big decision coming up, I think a wind farm off the coast of Scotland. A number of EU countries have decided not to go with Chinese wind turbines because they're worried about sabotage and other security concerns. So it'll be interesting to see how the UK behaves with that. But I think the difference is the UK is not a big manufacturing economy. It's increasingly evolved into a services-based economy. So I think the UK is not threatened by Chinese cars in the way that a country like Germany is. So I think people in the EU are watching closely what's happening in the UK, but I don't think the UK policy towards China is having a big impact on how the EU views it, because it's apples and oranges to a certain extent.
So as the EU faces nearly three more years of Trump and the continuing rise of China, what adjustments in its policy towards both powers do you think needs to happen in order to best prepare it for future developments in the competition?
Well, I think the EU is entering a difficult period where it's going to have to balance these two important relationships. I think with the US, what we've seen in the first year of Trump is the EU going out of its way to stay on the good side of the US, to keep the US engaged in Ukraine, for example, to clinch a trade deal with Washington that is asymmetric. It certainly hurts Europe more than it does the US. The US benefits much more from this trade deal. Europe's not the only grouping that has done this. I mean, the US has forced these deals on a lot of countries. I think the question in the US-EU relationship is how sustainable will this attempt to keep the US on side, how sustainable is that? If we're seeing with the war in Iran, how the US is creating new conflicts, and that will give it less bandwidth to focus on conflicts like the conflict in Ukraine, which is extremely important for Europe. The US is pressuring Europe when it comes to digital regulations. I don't think that is going to go away. Threats against Greenland could come back. So I think the question in the transatlantic relationship is really, is Europe going to be able to keep this relationship with the US on a semi-stable footing over the next 3 years under Trump? I think there are good reasons to question whether that's going to be possible. And with China, I think we're in a bit of a waiting game right now. I think because of these tensions in the transatlantic relationship, we're seeing an attempt to stay engaged with China, to avoid a sort of a major trade conflict with China. This is going to take very delicate negotiations, diplomacy, because Europe is feeling threatened by China economically. And if it doesn't push back, the impact on its economy, on the future of its industry is going to be pretty profound. So I think Europe, looking ahead to the next few years, it's going to be really about balancing and being very selective about where they push back. But one can't rule out forceful pushback vis-a-vis the US or China, I think.
Thank you. And that's a great place for us to finish. But before we do finish, I'd like to give you the opportunity to direct our listeners' attention to any recent or upcoming books, articles, or other projects you're working on that you think they might find to be of interest.
Well, at Rhodium, we're doing a lot of work on critical raw materials, the whole push to diversify away from China. So I think you'll see more of that coming up. We're obviously following the European debate on China very closely. And of course, I would recommend my month column, Watching China in Europe, to anyone who wants to follow the Europe-China debate more closely.
Fantastic. Well, our listeners can look out for those resources in our show notes. Just remains me to say, Noah Barkin, thank you so much for speaking to The Ballpark today.
Thanks for having me.
Noah Barkin is a senior advisor at the Rhodium Group. And that's it for this episode of The Ballpark. Thanks to Noah Barkin for joining us in this episode. For more information about the Phelan US Center, you can go to www.lse.ac.uk/united-states. On X and Instagram, we're at LSE_US, and on LinkedIn, we're at LSE United States. This episode of The Ballpark was produced by Chris Gilson and Avan Fata. A theme tune is by Ranger and the Rearrangers, a Seattle-based gypsy jazz band. You can look them up at rangerswings.com. To listen to all our previous episodes, just enter LSE Ballpark into your search engine of choice. You'll find us. We're free to listen to, and like lots of other podcasts, we're ad-free. We'd love to hear what you think about the show. You can email us any feedback at uscenter@lse.ac.uk, or you can send us a tweet at LSE_US, and tell your friends about us. If you like what you've heard, then please rate and review us via your podcast platform. It helps other people find the show. The content and opinions expressed in this podcast do not reflect those of the Phelan US Center or the London School of Economics. Thanks for listening.
Play ball!